For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so as we've been saying all along in our series, that David, a lot of things can be said about a lot of people that kind of summarize their life. And what the Bible puts forth about David is that he was a man after God's own heart. His was a heart that was wholly God's, it says. And so I guess I would really like, at the end of my life, for something similar to be said. I don't know about you. But this is kind of what we all really want, is that what our heart's about, what we desire most in life, what unifies the things about our experience and what we are trying to accomplish, would kind of reflect the heart of God. And so from David, we have a real window into what that looks like. And that's why we turn to the New Testament, and it says in Romans 15:4, this passage that we've looked at almost every time that we've had this study, whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction. It's not random that God put the story of David's life in the Bible for us to read, because through that, we might have perseverance. We'd learn how to stay at it. We'd understand that God's got greater things for us in our future than the things that we may be struggling with in the present. And for that reason, would receive encouragement of the Scriptures and hope. And so that's what this study is really all about, looking at the example of David so that we would have real hope about our life and where God is taking each one of us. Each of the narratives of David's life kind of open up to us, I think, a different feature of the heart of God that it's being instilled in the life of David. And tonight, we're going to talk about a heart of compassion. And it says in 2 Samuel 9, verse 3, "Is there anyone left," David asks, "in Saul's house, to whom I may share the kindness of God?" And so there's just a compassion or a kindness in David that really is set forth for us as a real picture of the kind of people God wants us to be. Let's pick up the narrative. It's a story about David and this guy with an unpronounceable name, Mephibosheth. There you go. And this is 2 Samuel 9. And it's kind of a cool story. It says in verse 1, "One day David asked, 'Is anyone in Saul's family still alive? Anyone who I can show kindness for Jonathan's sake?'" And so the key here is "for Jonathan's sake." And we've talked in weeks past about this cool relationship that David had with Jonathan, the intimacy of that and the bonds that they formed. And so David is here kind of reaching back in his memory. He's become the undisputed king now. Jerusalem is the capital city. He has been the recipient of this extraordinary promise that we talked about last time in chapter 7, that through him God would establish an eternal kingdom and that one of his sons would rule forever on the throne of God. Pretty cool. And so David, having kind of basked in that incredible blessing of God and having entered into a time of relative peace for Israel, is now kind of setting wistfully his mind backwards, thinking about his old friend Jonathan and a pledge that he made to Jonathan some years earlier. In 1 Samuel 20 and verse 42, it says, "We have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, 'The Lord will be between me and you, and between my descendants and your descendants forever.'" There's a commitment that Jonathan and David made to each other. Now, they knew they were both in a position to be the next king of Israel. Jonathan, because he was the son of the existing king, Saul, and David, because God had promised, you are my king. And so it's interesting, in the light of that reality, that both Jonathan and David knew, at the end of this story, one of us will be dead. And because that's just the way it always works. And but the relationship and the bond that we have with one another is going to have to transcend that. And so they enter into this relationship in which they swear to God that if I die, that you will take care of my family, and vice versa. And so David is really kind of walking back to that place, that the reminder of that relationship. And so he's asking this question, is there anyone left for the sake of Jonathan in Saul's house that I could take care of? Well, so in verse 2, it says that he summoned a man named Ziba who had been one of Saul's servants. Are you Ziba, the king asked? Yes, I am, Ziba replied. Then the king asked, is anyone still alive from Saul's family? If so, I want to show him the kindness of God. And Ziba replied, yes, one of Jonathan's sons is still alive. He's crippled in both feet. Where is he? The king asks. In Lo Debir, Ziba explained, at the home of Machir, son of Amiel. That guy. So David sent for him and brought him from Machir's home, and his name was Mephibosheth, and he was Jonathan's son and Saul's grandson. When he came to David, he bowed low to the ground with deep respect, and David greeted Mephibosheth, and he replied, I am your servant. Don't be afraid, David said. I intend to show you kindness because of my promise to your father Jonathan. I will give you all the property that once belonged to your grandfather Saul, and you will eat here with me at the king's table. Well, Mephibosheth bowed respectfully and exclaimed, who is your servant that you should show such kindness to a dead dog like me? And then the king summoned Ziba, Saul's servant, and said, I have given your master's grandson everything that belonged to Saul. You and your sons and servants are to farm the land for Mephibosheth's benefit, but he will eat here at my table. And Ziba had 15 sons and 20 servants. And Ziba replied, yes, my lord, the king, I am your servant, and I will do all that you have commanded. And from that time on, Mephibosheth ate regularly at David's table like one of the king's own sons. And Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah. From then on, all of the members of Ziba's household were Mephibosheth's servants. And Mephibosheth, who was crippled in both feet, lived in Jerusalem and ate regularly at the king's table. And so there's the story of David and Mephibosheth. What I want to do tonight is unpack a little bit about what's going on here and what are the heart issues that are at stake for David. First, there's Mephibosheth, and what is our description of him? Well, one is that he is the son of Jonathan and the grandson of Saul. And remember that there has been all these years of intrigue and conflict between the household of Saul and David. And so Saul was seeking the life of David, kind of scouring the countryside, trying to find him and kill him so that his rival might be destroyed. And so at the end of the day, when David actually prevails, the whole household of Saul becomes very scared. What's going to happen to us? They kind of scramble. Many of them die. The rest go into hiding. And we find out that in 2 Samuel chapter 4, verse 4, this baby, essentially, Mephibosheth, a very young man, was picked up by one of Saul's household servants, and as they were fleeing because the word had come out that Jonathan and Saul were dead and that David was now king, she grabs Mephibosheth, begins to run, stumbles and falls in such a way that Mephibosheth's legs were permanently rendered virtually useless. Perhaps a spinal injury. We don't know exactly what it is, but we do know that from very early on, this was Mephibosheth's thing. And so he's living more or less in hiding in this place, Lo Debir. Why? Because he is on the losing side of this dynastic switch. And as somebody who's on the losing end, he could expect that the victor is going to come and, like they do in every empire, destroy the remnants of the family of the previous dynasty. That's just always how it works. And so he's hiding out. He's living in fear. But not just living in fear, he's also a crippled man living in helpless dependency. unable to provide for himself, dependent upon the generosity of anybody who might come to his aid. And so he found such a man in this town called Lo-Debir. And so Mephibosheth really paints for us a picture of somebody who's in a great place of need. One who from a certain perspective could be viewed as an enemy of the existing regime. And for these reasons, it would be totally unexpected for him to get a visit from David the king with the kind of news that David had brought to him. And so let's talk about that part just a little bit, the kindness of David. Twice this language is used, verse 1 and verse 7. He wants to show kindness for Jonathan's sake. I will surely show kindness to you, he says. What does this mean, kindness? Does it mean he just wants to be a nice fella? You know, mannerly or something like that? The kind of guy who says nice things about you, never says bad things about you. That's nice, right? That's kind, I suppose, in a certain syrupy kind of way. But that's not what the biblical word here means. The word here is hesed. And it is an extremely important word in the Old Testament. Hesed means a faithful, merciful love rooted in compassion and affection. And so David, his heart full of hesed, his kindness, is seeking opportunities. And he's seeking out the household of Jonathan. And is there anybody that I can demonstrate my faithfulness, my merciful love, the compassion and affection that I had for Jonathan that I can now give to his son? And so that's what that's really all about. And it really, in a practical way, comes down to three things. To display this hesed, this loving kindness, first is to make a provision for Mephibosheth. A provision in which this guy who's crippled in both feet, as it says twice in the narrative, who lived in Jerusalem and would eat regularly at the king's table. Mephibosheth was poor. He was without means of meeting his own needs or the needs of his son or anyone else. And so kindness means going and meeting that most pressing and that most real need. How can you say that you're kind to someone and overlook the most glaring needs that exist in their life? And so to have the kindness that he's describing is to be sensitive to what are the real pressing needs going on in this person's life. And then secondly, there's the issue of protection. Think about this. It says in verse 10, you and your sons and servants are to farm the land for Mephibosheth's benefit. He's talking to Ziba here. Ziba is this guy who we would envision pretty much as a guy who's taking advantage of a situation. He's the last servant in the household of Saul, which means that basically he's the steward of all the land that Saul possessed and all of his wealth that hadn't already been taken. And he's also sort of the caretaker of this guy Mephibosheth. But as you can see, Mephibosheth's not even living with him. What kind of a caretaker is that? And instead, he's using this land to benefit himself and his fairly large family, 12 sons and 20 servants. And so David's like, No, that's not the way this is going to go down. You're not going to take advantage of the capacities of this young man. Instead, you and your sons and your servants are going to farm this land for for the dude's benefit. I knew that was going to happen at a certain point. It's like the most impossible word in the Bible to read. Mephibosheth. There you go. Ziba was kind of on the take. He was in it for himself. And David's like, it's not going to go down that way anymore. And the loving kindness that he describes here and his evidences here is a real concern for the protection of the vulnerable. And then lastly, there is this issue of position. Here is Mephibosheth, and he refers to himself as a dead dog. That's not a good day when that's how you refer to yourself. But David responds and he says, well, here's the deal. You are going to eat at my table regularly. Four times in this fairly brief narrative, David makes this point, you're going to eat at my table. And in verse 11, I just love what he says, is that you're going to eat at David's table like one of the king's own sons. And so just imagine the reversal here. Somebody who's on the losing side in basically what had been a civil war and the emergence of a new dynasty is now considered essentially a family member of the victor. That is incredible. And it's a beautiful picture, not just of David being a really cool guy. The importance of this story is not just what David has done for this man, but that it paints a deeper picture. Namely, that the hesed that David expresses is the hesed that God had shown him, the loving kindness of God to him. Let's look at the most important verse in the Bible about the character of God. It's important that we understand that David is saying, it's not my loving kindness that I want to show, it's the loving kindness of God. And this is what the loving kindness of God looks like. Exodus 34, verses 6 and 7. Moses is in this place right before this paragraph that I'm going to read to you, where he is calling out to God. He's saying, show me your glory. Show me who you really are. God, you've done incredible things in liberating us from the Egyptians, but who are you? What is the essence of who you are? And God says, well, I'll tell you who I am. And so the Lord proclaimed, the Lord God, here's who I am, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness and truth, and one who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin, and yet will not by any means leave the guilty unpunished. We ask this question, you know, what is God really like? What's God about? What makes God God? And God answers this question for us right here. And at the heart of who God identifies himself as being is one who is abounding in loving kindness and who continues or keeps loving kindness for thousands. That's this word. That's what hesed is and what David is describing in his own dealings with Mephibosheth. Let's talk about that just a little bit more. I love the commentary given to this by J.I. Packer in his book, Knowing God. When it says that, when God says, I abound in loving kindness, Packer notes that generosity, this abounding element of his loving kindness, means a disposition to give to others, not limited by what the recipients deserve. What did Mephibosheth deserve? What did he deserve? He didn't deserve to be brought into David's family and made a son. And yet that's how David dealt with him. And that's how God deals with us. And he says generosity is the focal point of God's moral perfection. It is the quality which determines how all of God's other excellencies are to be displayed. God overflows, he says, with generosity. God is not stingy. God is not, I'll meet you halfway. God's disposition toward all of us is generous, that he will give anything and everything that he has at his disposal if it would just meet the need of a person who would identify himself with the qualities of someone like Mephibosheth. That's why he did not spare even his own son, but sent him into the world to deal with the basic and deep and abiding problems that human beings have before God. He's holding nothing back from you. Don't you ever let it enter into your mind that God is being stingy with you, that God is just throwing little morsels your way to tease you into taking that next step of faith with him, only to leave you in the dark and drive you to a place which, if you knew what the whole story was, you'd never go. That's not the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible is a God who richly and just lavishes on to us everything that we need. I think that it said so well, this picture of God that he gives himself for us in Exodus 34. The Jewish scholar Abraham Heschel, in commenting on this in his book, The Prophets, says, the bricks we collect to construct the biblical image of God are, as a rule, conceptual ideas like goodness, justice, wisdom, unity. It's like a philosophical kind of definition of God. God's omnipotent, God's omniscient, God's unchanging, all of these things about God. But he makes this important point. He says, in terms of frequency of usage in biblical language, if we're going to emphasize, in other words, what the Bible itself emphasizes about God, these things are surpassed by statements referring to God's pathos, it says. Pathos, he says, denotes not an idea or a philosophy of goodness, but a living care, a dynamic relationship between God and man, where God is moved by the condition of humanity, moved by the suffering that he sees in the lives of people who've been broken on the anvil of a world that is far from him, and that ultimately rests under his judgment. And God looks at the circumstances of our lives with all of its complexity, with all of its failure, and it says that moves God. He feels something. The Lord, the compassionate. That's the first descriptor out of God's mouth. Compassion means literally to feel along with another person. It's the same language that is used of a mother's tender affection for her newborn child. And what God is telling us is that I'm not neutral about you. You're not just pieces on a chessboard that are a part of the game of history. Oh no, I know. In real terms, that's what pathos means. In real terms, I feel, because God is personal. God is able to experience the confusion that we have, the lostness that we feel, the pains that we endure. It was he who entered into the theater of human history personally to experience the whole range of things that we experience in this life so that he could both deal with that problem and so that he could look us in the eye and say, I know how you feel. I know what's going on in your heart. Not just abstractly, but I've experienced these same things myself. In Romans chapter 5, Paul just kind of lays this out and in really a consistent way with what we've been describing here about the hesed of God. He says, while we were still helpless, Christ died for the ungodly. While we were helpless, in his mercy and in his compassion, his loving kindness is engaged. Just like David's love of Mephibosheth. He sees him in this helpless place and he moves towards him. You know, maybe some of us tonight we understand that sense of helplessness. Maybe we've been battling some things within, some what we might call our inner demons, and we feel that we're losing ground. We're feeling that while is more than anything we would want tomorrow to be different than yesterday, in the back of our minds we know that no, it's just not going to be any different. We've been resigned to surrender ourselves to the slavery of our own character, our own weaknesses, our own separation from God that has just left us in this place of abandonment. While you are still hopeless, helpless, Christ died for the ungodly. He died for you. When there was nothing you could bring to the table, God provided everything that you needed in the death of Christ. In verse 8, he says, God demonstrated his own love toward us in that while we were still sinners, he died for us. Here's this thing, that the hesed, the loving kindness of God, is something that is never deserved, never earned. The way that we receive loving kindness from God, in fact, is quite the opposite. It's to confess and to agree with him how undeserving we truly are. So we may identify on an emotional level, in a kind of a deep inner way, the sense of helplessness that we feel in our lives. But here, God is bringing our attention to the deeper root of that, which is that we are sinners, that we are separated from God, we are alienated from God because we've gone our own way. It's a condition of the heart that is at the real core of the problems in your life. Now, it may be that you've experienced difficult and painful things in life. We all have. But none of the things that life hands to us are as crippling as the things that we do to ourselves. And that is what it means to be a sinner, is to violate God's design, God's purpose for our lives. We're free to defy God, but we're not free with respect to the consequences of defying God, because we live as creatures in a world that God created. And when we defy him, we bring great damage upon ourselves. And Christ, because he is the very embodiment of the love of God, the undeserved favor and kindness of God, came into the world to die, to deal with that problem. The wages of sin is death, we're told. To defy God is to be rejected by him, to stand under his just judgment. But the love of God is that he came into the world to take upon himself the judgment that we deserve. That is what the gospel or the good news is. And so he simply calls upon us to move towards him with the open hands of faith to say, be merciful to me, I'm a sinful person. And God delights then if we are coming to a place where we actually agree with him and humble ourselves to receive what we do not deserve. We're helpless, just like Mephibosheth. Yes, we are sinners, all. And even more so, he says in verse 10, this is Romans chapter 5, while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his son. Mephibosheth was an enemy. He was in the wrong family. And David had compassion and mercy and the loving kindness of God he showed to this man, not because he deserved it, not because he was part of the tribe, not because he was a part of the family, but because he wasn't, because he was an enemy. And it is the loving kindness of God alone that can take someone who is an enemy and turn him into a son or daughter. And that is God's intent. Not to just say, okay, you're forgiven, now just go and do whatever. We're made right before God. We're justified by God for a purpose. And that purpose is then to be adopted as a son or daughter into his family. That is the real blessing that comes with the loving kindness of God. That's the ultimate purpose of God's loving kindness. It is to make enemies sons. And so David shows this to Mephibosheth. He says, it's not just that I'm going to take care of your needs in some impersonal and distant way. It isn't just that I'm calling a truce between your family and mine. No, I'm bringing you to the table. You're a part of my household. The same loyalty and love and tenderness that a father has for his children, David is saying, I have that for you. I have that for all of you. Now, there's a a feeling, a sense that we have because we are accustomed to living life apart from God. That we are, in that sense, undesirable, unacceptable. And we keep God, for that reason, at a distance because we sense I'm just not like God. And in passages like this, in Romans 5, verse 10, he's calling to you. And he's saying, look, the war is over. It's over. And now we are in a time of peace. And I want you to come to my table, not slinking there, calling yourself a dead dog, as Mephibosheth did, but as a son that you truly are, as an inheritor of all that I have to give. And this is what God wants to extend to us. I think that's a pretty sweet picture. That's God's hesed and his pledge to all who would humble themselves and to receive this forgiveness that he freely offers and to become a part of his family. Now, let's move on and apply this to our own situation. We've seen the example of David. We recognize that the example of David is rooted in the reality of who God is. And now let's take that next step and say, okay, then what about me and you? What about us? How does this relate to us in an ongoing sort of way? What can we learn? Well, the first thing that comes to my mind as I think about this is that the loving kindness that David showed, in which God is not something that comes to us very naturally. Are you that kind of person who can look at an enemy and say, hey, we're enemies, but I'm prepared to sacrifice absolutely everything of value I have to demonstrate my love for you? How's that going in your life, your marriage? Yeah, I thought so. Because you're like me and like everybody else, which is that we are, by fallen nature, we are selfish. We are looking out for our interests. We want people to earn our acceptance, while at the same time demanding, of course, that they accept us unconditionally, but that's a little bit of hypocrisy. What I'm trying to say is God wants to do something supernatural in your life. And in the New Testament, that is called, in Galatians chapter 5, the fruits of the Spirit. It is the work of God. What is he trying to do to shape and to mold your heart? Well, the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control. Those are the things that God is trying to build in your life. And kindness is a part of that. And this gives it, it's an echo of this great biblical picture of the kindness of God. And so we may be saying to ourselves, you know, what can I possibly get out of a passage like this? Well, how about just a reminder that you're not like God yet? And that he's given you a picture of who he is so that we can begin that process of reflection that brings us to that place where we really authentically begin to desire the things that God is really about. And I want to just say a couple things about that. First is that to really begin to develop within our hearts the heart of God means that we seek the heart of God. And what do I mean by that? Well, in Micah chapter 6, verse 8, the prophet says, what does the Lord require of you? After saying, I'm not looking for your sacrifices, I'm not looking for your fasting, I'm not interested in any of that stuff. He says, what I'm interested in is that you do justice, that you love kindness, and walk humbly with your God. That's the picture that God lays out before his people. He's calling on us to have a generous mercy through a grateful reflection on his own compassion towards us. Really, the font of all real change occurs at that time where we realize how God has been so generous to us because we cannot give what we do not have. And David, I think, puts it so well. He says in 2 Samuel 7, the passage that we were looking at last time, "Who am I and what is my house that you have brought me this far, God?" And David is like, "Look, I was a shepherd out in the field. I was a nobody. You've made me the king of this great country. Who am I? What is my house that you have done these great things for me?" And it's just that generosity from God and his mercy that David reflects on, and it produces this heart of gratitude that God is generous in his mercy, God is full of compassion, and that anybody who truly understands how God has been towards them through a reflection like this, through your own reflection, how would you fill in the blank? Who am I? And what is my house that you have brought me this far? Can you imagine where you would be without the loving kindness of God pursuing you through your life? You have a picture of what that might look like. I do. It isn't a pretty picture. And for that reason, I'm really grateful. And I really do believe, with all the sincerity of my heart, that there's nothing I have that hasn't been given to me by the generosity of God. I don't deserve the children I have, the wife I have, the friends I have, the work I do, the place and time that I occupy, or its place, or I said that wrong. My time and place are not my choosing. God has been gracious and given me all of those things. God has blessed you beyond anything that you could possibly imagine. And if that's where we're prepared to start, from that place of deep gratitude, that abiding sense of God's generosity toward you, then it's easier then to cultivate his heart for other people. A humble identification with the helpless as a response to God's care. It's the ability to look at your life, remember the helplessness of your circumstance and how God reached out that hand to you and drew you out of that. And to be able to therefore identify with the helpless as a response to this care that God has shown to you. Look, there are people in our lives who feel just as Mephibosheth did, like a dead dog, like someone who's not worth the thought of another, like one who is in this broken place where there's a sense of helplessness about their life. And God has placed us at that intersection to demonstrate his loving kindness. You know, one of the things that keeps this fresh in my heart is that I grew up in a family where one of our family members is significantly physically disabled and is even more pronounced way developmentally disabled. And I have seen her struggle through getting an education, and I've seen her struggle to work. And at her age now, her body just aches all the time. And I remember growing up, because of her deformities, being the subject of constant and unrelenting ridicule by other kids. Kids are evil. Even your kids are evil. And so having been in a household where that's just constantly going on, there's something that you either become hardened and you just don't care anymore, or it breaks your heart and enables you to, in a sympathetic and real way, understand and identify with really broken people. God sides with the brokenhearted, we're told. God sides with the poor, with the outcast, the orphan, the widow. We have to find a way to, with real humility, identify with the broken people in our life and in our world. What, you say? There are no such people in my life who are like that. Really? I think so. Here's our last point. If we realize what we really need is a heart of gratitude that we are the generous recipients of God's mercies, and if we are able to find within our heart a desire to truly identify ourselves with the broken around us, then we seek the opportunity. What is the opportunity? David, I mean, just the point is kind of important that comes out of this passage. David wasn't sitting on his throne being fed grapes and fanned with a big fig leaf or whatever the image of a king would be. No. He's like, I'm going to go out and I'm going to find this guy. And that's what he did. He went and he sought the opportunity to demonstrate the loving kindness of God. And that, I think, means a couple of things tangibly for us. I don't think that we have to go very far to develop the loving kindness of God. And that there are distress signals coming from sectors of our life all around us. The problem is that our compassionometer is shut off. We got to get before God and flip that switch, because then we're going to start hearing the blip, 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 and things are going to get our attention, and we're going to be able to see the situations for what they really are. I wonder how often we really take the time to listen. You know, we live in a culture that is very superficial. And the way that people interact with one another is glib, is, well, you know what a suburban refusal is, right? Yeah, I'll be there. Okay? No one's real. No one's honest. And you can just say, well, okay. So, you lied to me or whatever. And next person. Or you could say, I wonder why it is that this person that I had this relationship would feel that they must just lie to my face and never at all intend to respond to an invitation that I've given them to go out for a beer or whatever it is. What's going on in their soul, in their heart? And now it's time to, in a prayerful way, listen to what's being said, sometimes listening for things that are unsaid, to be discerning observers of the lives of the people around us so that we can have a window into what is going on in the heart of a person. We know for a fact that everyone who is far from God is in distress because they are resisting the movement of God towards them. They're being warned by that. They're trying to find reasons for why they really have it together when deep down in their hearts they know that they don't. They're going from one meaningless experience to another as substitutes for real relationship, for intimacy, for trust and things of this nature. When we're listening, when we are present in our workplace, in our neighborhoods, in whatever. If we're listening, we will hear. We'll hear the unspoken or the garbled pleas of the heart. It's going to be there. And that provides an opportunity for us to then move towards and to show the loving kindness of God. But we're not oftentimes listening. We're too caught up in our own head. Most of us in conversations are thinking about one thing when the other person is talking. Am I right? You're thinking to yourself, what am I going to say next? Right? We're worried about that. Am I going to have the right answer? Or am I going to be charming and interesting enough to continue the conversation or whatever it is? And if we are present and we are listening, and we're putting ourselves on the back burner to move into the thought life of another, we will hear the distress signals of the heart, And God will give us the capacity to respond in an appropriate and effective way. I suppose, too, just like David, leaving the comforts of his own cedar-clad palace, there's just that need to be taken out of our strides, out of what's comfortable for us, to move places that might be inconvenient so that we can be in the presence of those for whom compassion is a desperate need. And I think that that's something that we see quite a bit around this fellowship. I'm really thrilled to be a part of a church where there are all kinds of ministries going on to people who are in pain, people who are in need without resources, whether they are settled refugees or international students or people in our health clinics, things like that. We have opportunity to move towards the real needy. And I just want to encourage us that that is really deep in the heart of God. That's what God seeks. God seeks the lonely, the brokenhearted, and he calls his people into that. So I think that this characteristic of God that we're describing in the heart of David here is something that God wants for us too. And there is a joy that comes with that. David, what was the result for David? Well, he got a new son. That's pretty sweet. A new son to put around his table and just have a delight in that relationship. And I think all of us can say who've really reached out in this way to care for people, regardless of how they may respond to us, that when they sometimes do respond, there's a bond that gets formed, an intimacy, a touching of hearts that is just so fulfilling and so rich and so real and so beautiful. And we begin to realize this is why God has set it up this way, is so that we can experience more fully, more truly, the heart of God itself as we go and do the things that God does. So there's a blessing in this, something really sweet in this that God wants to have for your life. If you're here tonight and you're feeling a little dry spiritually, you're like, you know, I'm doing all the right things and I'm just not feeling it. Ever been like that before? Maybe the focus has been upon yourself a little bit more than it could be. And instead, if we're thinking here about the kind of person that God is calling on us to be and is shaping us into being through these fruits of the Spirit and seeking the opportunity to really cultivate that, your life will change. You're going to find something real that you didn't have before.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.